We're speaking with Robert H. Boyle, author of The Hudson, A Natural and Unnatural History, about the ecology of the river. To learn more about anything you hear on this program, visit us at www.hudsonriver.vassar.edu. Coming up on the Hudson River, the Eco Calendar, a soundscape from the river's very source, and more. Next, we'll continue with our interview of Boyle. He describes how the Hudson is like a deep beer cooler, but begins by highlighting some of the river's unique qualities.
There are a number of things going for it. The bedrock geology, its location, the Gulf Stream, the temperature changes, and then the other big factor, of course, is the tidal effect. In an orthodox river, if you will, which only flows one way, many of the nutrients are washed downstream. In the northeastern United States, 99% of the energy of a stream, if you will, the basic food stock, to put it another way, that sustains a stream, is not the vegetation or what's in the stream, but it's the outside material that falls in, what the scientists call the allochthonous material. And that is best signified by the fall of leaves in the autumn. But the fall of leaves in the autumn is a tremendously important transfer of energy. And it is so obvious, it's so subtle. Homeowners think of it as a pain in the neck. I've got to go out and rake the leaves. But it's the leaves, to a great extent, that fall into streams that sustain life in the stream. That's what the invertebrates start to chomp on, and then the fish eat the invertebrates. And you can see this if you go to one of the tributaries of the Hudson and pick up a leaf and look at it. You'll see where it's been skeletonized, either, I don't know, by a stonefly or by a mayfly or a caddisfly or some other creature. But in the lower Hudson, the estuary, the tidal estuary, the leaves and the marsh plants, any of the vegetable detritus that comes in, this allochthonous material, is not immediately washed out to sea. It's held in place by the rocking tides. And in the spring, when a very important species of fish come into spawn, such as the striped bass, the blueback herring, alewives, the American shad, and Atlantic sturgeon, when they come in to spawn in the spring, they generally go upriver, deposit their eggs. Then when the eggs hatch, say with the striped bass, for about anywhere from 3 to 5 days, the larval striped bass feeds on its yolk sac. Given a good year, when things go right, that young striped bass, just as it's exhausted its yolk sac, which it feeds off of, is carried in to sort of a great supermarket of detritus that's been held in place by the tidal action. It's a great synchronization between biology and time.
But is this like a moving, not only in time, but a moving grocery store in place?
That's right. And things can happen to upset it. I can remember one day in early May when, this was back in the 60s, the Hudson Valley got 5 inches of rain in, you know, like 24 hours. And it shunted that whole supermarket down below and sort of out of sight. Then you'll get times when striped bass will come in and spawn. And we have perhaps 2 million mature fish that come in to spawn on the river, generally in the area between, most of them, between Kingston and Catskill. And they can spawn, cast their eggs into the water column, everything is fine, but then you can get a savage cold front that can come through, and it can zap the eggs, or zap the young. It's a moving system. It all depends what they find of their liking. They have to spawn in fresh water. They can't spawn in an orthodox river that only flows downhill unless that river is at least 50 miles long. You need a moving system that can keep the eggs in motion and off the bottom, for striped bass in any event.
Now, this moving system and this dichotomy that you spoke of earlier between the northern part of the Hudson and the southern part, or the upstream and the downstream.
Yes, the upstream and the estuary.
That's really very much influenced by man, is it not, in the fact that Troy, the reason the demarcation is at Troy is because there's a dam.
There's a dam there, but there was also, fish could pass up through there before the dam was put, but it still flowed downstream. It's not as though the tide extended above Troy. The tide never extended above Troy.
Is that why they positioned it there? Or?
Yeah, they positioned it there. There was a rocky rise, if you will. It was a natural place if you're going to put a dam. They didn't put it on the main stem of the tidal Hudson to interfere with the system. It interfered somewhat, and it prevented, well, there are historical accounts of Atlantic sturgeon being in the Hudson north of Troy before the dam was put in. And when things go right, you will find fish going through the lock and dam system. The other thing that's happened, and people don't realize this, and I never knew about it myself until I was reading a book by a man named Fred Mather. He was born near Troy about 1830, and Fred Mather writes that when he was a boy, when the ice would break up on the Hudson, when there would be the snow melt in the Adirondacks and the water would surge down and it would break up the ice, but it would pile up the ice below Albany, maybe 10 or 12 miles below Albany, and it would create sort of a great ice dam. And the water would then flood the lowlands for miles around the Albany area. In fact, he talks about people taking a rowboat out on streets in Albany. But that's been altered. That doesn't happen anymore. And it was part of the system at the time. If you're going to say the Hudson had a delta, you'd say that the delta was below Albany because all of the silt and other stuff that would be carried down, rushing down from the Adirondacks, would meet the tides and then would settle out because of the rocking action of the tides. And you do have islands in the river up there.
Going back to a comment you made about the Hudson being a shoestring version of the Chesapeake earlier in this interview, it seems that the geography and the geology relates that in the sense that it's very narrow as opposed to being spread out and veinated, you know, like the bay.
The Hudson River has been likened to a deep beer cooler, and the Chesapeake has been likened to a very shallow soup dish.
You mentioned the Hudson compared to a deep beer cooler. Then can you tell us where we should dive? Mr. Boyle never did answer that question.
From the Almanac, August 16th through 18th, Mount Marcy, mile 315. We made a pre-college semester hike in the woods up the south side of Mount Marcy, a first for all of us. We had perfect weather, high spirits, heavy packs, and we were very sore by the end of our three-day trip. We practically swam our way up Calamity Brook, the Opalescent River, and Feldspar Brook, through beautiful pools, cascades, plumes, and potholes to Lake Tyr. The water was remarkably colder as we rose in elevation. We finally reached Lake Tyr after some 8 hours of hiking over 2 days. This is a small, shallow pond ringed with fir and spruce. The trail skirts the south side, and from there we went up and down Skylight and Marcy over the next few hours. This is the place where the Hudson is born, today in haze and heat with Lake Tyr of the clouds sparkling over 1,000 feet below us. As we plunged our way down again through the opalescent cascades, I thought about what I had seen at the headwaters. Cold water, opalescent air, rocks of every size, huge room-sized boulders down to small cobbles jammed into crevices. Mosses, overhanging cedars, white birch, spruce, and ever-changing water, washing rock downhill. This observation was contributed by Doug Reed. I'm Sean Anderson.
The Hudson River Almanac is an annual natural history journal compiled from the contributions of over 1,700 volunteers. Links on how to contribute materials or obtain copies are at www.hudsonriver.vassar.edu.
Time for the Hudson River Eco Calendar. I'm Jen Logan. Talking benches, cooking grills shaped like animals, sculptural binoculars and films aboard a floating cinema are all among the outdoor artworks unfolding over the next 2 years along an 80-mile stretch of the Hudson between Bear Mountain and Albany, New York. Saturday, May 24th marks the official opening of Watershed, the Hudson Valley Art Project, this pilot program of about a dozen commissioned public artworks sponsored by Minetta Brook, a nonprofit arts organization. For more information, you can contact 845-831-4129. That's 845-831-4129. But if you feel like actually getting out on the river, the Hudson River National Estuarine Research Reserve is sponsoring a series of canoe trips to some of the river's biggest marshes in New York State. These include Stockport Flats, Iona Island, nestled at the base of Bear Mountain in Rockland County, Tivoli Bay, and extensive marshes in Dutchess County. Trips are free and open to the public, though reservations are required. And you needn't have your own boat, as canoes, paddles, and safety gear are all provided. For more information, call the Hudson River National Estuarine Research Reserve at 845-758-7016. That's 845-758-7016.
Next week, we learn about a 2-year display of art at 10 outdoor locations along an 80-mile stretch of the Hudson River between Bear Mountain and Albany. Classical composer Joseph Bertolozzi tells us about a rock along the Hudson in Poughkeepsie that has served as an inspiration for his music. All this and more on the Hudson River. At 5,344 feet, Mount Marcy in the Adirondacks is New York State's highest peak. Perched on its shoulder about 1,000 feet below Marcy's summit, tiny Lake Tier of the Clouds is by the definition of geographers the source of the Hudson River. On this week's Hudson River Soundscape, we listen to Ania Lockwood's recording of Lake Tier made on a typically windy day in June 1982. The Hudson River is produced in association with Vassar College, its Environmental Studies Program, and its Journalism Forum. Our student assistant producers are digital editor Sean Anderson and researcher Shalu Bire. Professor Randy Cornelius is the project director. I'm your host, Mark Breslov, producer and project manager. Unless otherwise indicated, all natural sounds used on this program are from Ania Lockwood's recording, A Sound Map of the Hudson River, on the Lovely Music label. This project has been funded in part by a grant from the New York State Environmental Protection Fund through the Hudson River Estuary Program. Special thanks to Fran Dunwell and Steve Stan of the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Additional support for this program comes from Vassar College, with thanks to Susan Kuiper. Thanks also to Steve Rath. To listen to this program again, or for more information, visit www.hudsonriver.vassar.edu. Email us at hudsonriver@vassar.edu.
I like your snow-capped mountains and your valleys oh so fair, and the beauty of your countryside I'm sure can't be compared. So many things to see and do, I'll sing them in my song. Still I've got to travel home, it's there that I belong. You could see my Hudson River rolling on. You know I want to be back home where I belong. Her beauty and her majesty still linger on my mind. I just love to stand beside her as she moves on down the line. Ought to see those lumbering barges heading north to Albany, oil tankers heading south to New York City, then out to sea. And still my river flows along just like the hands of time. You see, I just can't get that Hudson River off my mind. You could see my Hudson River rolling down. You know I want to be back home where I belong. Her beauty and her majesty still linger on my mind. I just love to stand beside her as she moves on down the line.
they say that she is born high in a mountain way up north. In a small stream down a rocky slope, she finds her place of birth. A lot of tiny streams combine to make my river strong, cutting through the Adirondacks to the valley that's my home. You could see my Hudson River.